Welcome back to the Rebel Podcast. As always, this is P. Nate, and this is the podcast for cultural engagement brought to you by the Ezra Institute. This is a part of our series, ongoing series called How to Win the World, and I have an awesome first-time guest with us today. So welcome, Ben Garrett.
Man, thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. This is exciting. We met down very briefly at the Right Response Conference in Texas. Yep. And I haven't had any chance to kind of do some follow-up or any sort of ministry together. So this is really exciting for me. I am an Ogden fan. I love what you guys are doing down there. I love Haunted Cosmos. So thanks so much for being on here. And thanks for all the good ministry that you guys are doing.
Man, no, thank you. Seriously, it just means the world that, you know, guys like you at the Ezra Institute and the stuff that y'all put out would even, you know, care to look on us peons in Ogden. So it's super humbling. And I really enjoyed meeting you. And I hope we can interface more and more. So I'm just glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can work to that end. This series that we've been going through called How to Win the World, we've been looking at sort of just practical ways, things that Christians ought to focus on, ways that Christians ought to think in order to engage the culture in a way that would win it. And we've had some great guests. We've talked to Pastor Doug Wilson about warring with our worship. We've had Pastor C.R. Wiley on to talk about creating anti-fragile biblical homes. We've talked to Toby Sumter. We've talked to Josh Howard, a lot of great guys. And this actual segment, I suppose, is a little bit different because this episode is going to be called Tell Better Stories. And before we kind of connect it to the big idea of this podcast series, just in case any of our listeners have been sort of living under a rock for the last little while and don't know anything about who you are and what it is that you do, obviously they weren't following the Dead Man Walking podcast tournament throwdown where you guys won the whole thing. But Ben, you are one of the hosts of Haunted Cosmos, which is a podcast that kind of looks at, I guess, the strange and the weird and the paranormal from a biblical perspective. And this was like, I remember listening to Blurry Creatures for a number of years prior to you guys starting this. And I remember having to fight the envy in my heart and spirit, having you guys jump into this space and do such a great job at it. So why don't you tell our listeners, in case they haven't heard of you, a little bit about what you do at Haunted Cosmos.
Yeah, no, thanks. That's really high praise, being compared to those guys. We basically wanted to start a podcast that was like, okay, we're very interested in the world that God made. We think that Christians ought to be interested in the world that God made. And so why don't we pick some of the most interesting things and just talk about them? And, you know, kind of coincidentally, the most interesting things, especially this is just part of the human condition, tends to be the ones that we don't know that much about, you know, mysterious things, things like, well, how come a bunch of people say that they see this big hairy man in the woods? Could that be legit? How come people say they see these strange lights in the sky and then they get weird scars on their leg and back? You know, what's going on with that? And so the more that we dug into these kind of, they're called Fortean topics. Fortean is a whole genre of story that's just connected to high strangeness. And the more we dug into them, just at a personal level of interest, the more we realized that, no, there could be something here, and it's worth exploring, and it helps that the stories themselves just tend to be so naturally gripping and compelling. So we started Haunted Cosmos, and we really try to emphasize the episodes being story-driven. So we don't even give nearly as much hard data as some other Fortean high strangeness shows do, whether Christian or non-Christian. Instead, we just try to compel people with the stories and get them thinking about, well, what if I do live in that kind of world? Then what am I supposed to do? How should I think? How should I worship? All those things.
Yeah, that's really good. And you kind of broached the topic of stories, which I do want to talk about. But before I do, just kind of touching on what it is that you guys do, one of the things that I appreciate, you know, I was sort of less interested in the Bigfoot kind of stuff and Loch Ness Monster and these sorts of things. But what I've always been really interested in is the idea of mythology, right? So I have my degree is in English literature. I minored in cultural studies, and that came with it a lot of Greek mythology, Roman mythology. And what's so interesting to me, when you start getting guys who are getting popular, like the Graham Hancocks of the world, who start looking at the various mythologies and stories of ancient peoples and start saying, well, these are really interesting because there's so much in common. And and what I've kind of learned, I guess, from you guys as you've walked through your seasons, you guys do a really good job at sort of having the seasons flow in such a way where you're exploring a few things and then tie them together with a great episode at the end where you kind of bring these threads together. And it's been really thrilling. But one of the things you guys say that I thought is just a brilliant, simple thing is, you know, when we're talking about any sort of high strangeness, whether it's people who have had encounters with what they think are extraterrestrials or whatever, is you say, yeah, people can lie, but people don't only lie. And when we have this mass amount of data of people who have experienced things that go beyond just a material world, we sort of have to start asking the question, well, if all these people are lying, why do so many of their stories sound so similar? And why are they so similar to so many ancient peoples who wrote these things down and put them on cave walls and on pottery all these years ago?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of these, it's one of our favorite topics, and it's just this general topic of mytho-history. So one of the conclusions that I drew at the end of this past season, season three, was talking about things like, okay, when you pick up Homer's Iliad, and when you pick up Homer's Odyssey, or even Virgil's Aeneid, you know, even though it was written much later, you're not just reading something that they completely made up out of thin air. You're not just reading something that they sat down one day, you know, Homer, whoever Homer was, by the way, and Virgil, and just thought, I'm going to create something new. No, they're at the very least, they're being driven by an oral tradition of history that was passed down for centuries, you know, generations through centuries. And it's my opinion that a lot of those things actually find their nos or their loci, their locus in something true, something that did actually happen. And part of why I think that is because of what you're saying, that there are other mythologies like Hesiod's Theogony and, you know, the Babylonian mythology and Native American, all these things, they all have echoes of one another. And all of those echoes find their source, obviously, in scripture. We have this true myth, is what I like to call it, this true thing that really did happen, but that's no less mythical in its scope and in its scale and all that it deals with. And we have there something true. And with that truth, we can then compare it to all of these other myths. And we find that a lot of them are saying things that at the root really did happen. They're just telling you about it from a twisted lens or a corrupted lens, or they don't have all the information or whatever it may be. But that doesn't mean that they're all just made up and false. And so, yeah, when you go to things like the Iliad or the Aeneid, you can say, yeah. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that this is like a, you know, some history textbook or something like that. But it is a form of history. It's just mytho-history. And when we start to read the past through that lens, not only does it get more interesting, but I think that it makes the Bible and the truth of Christianity even more compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get there as well. But why don't we just start? Because I think I kind of joked, you guys really did win a tournament about the best podcasts out there, and you beat some great ones like Cross Politic and Plodcast. So I just say that to say there's obviously, you guys have obviously hit an interest. And I think there's a couple things going on. I think number one, materialism has so sapped joy and intrigue and mystery out of the world that I think there's a whole generation of young people who want to see the world re-enchanted. And so I think that's one thing that you guys have hit on. So feel free to touch on that as well. But I think the second point is that, and this kind of gets to the theme of this episode, is that you guys are great storytellers. And I don't know if that's something that you, I don't know if that's something that you've always been good at, or maybe Brian's been good at it and you've been kind of learning, or vice versa, but like, you guys are just great at telling stories, word choice, it's beautiful prose. You do a great job at just telling stories. And so it's story driven, right? And so that's what kind of sets you apart from the blurry creatures or whatever else kind of runs in these genres, is it's story driven. So talk a little bit about maybe the choice to make this project so story driven.
Yeah, no. So it's funny because that ties into the whole desire for enchantment as well. I think that one of the things you lose when you get materialism is the truth about the nature of the world, which is that I actually do think that it's haunted. Like it's a kitschy kind of title for a show, but I actually think that we do live in a cosmos that is haunted by many things, by, you know, the fall of man, by the love of God, by God himself and his glory that's revealed in creation. Of course, by the blood of the Son shed to save the world. Like we're haunted by all those things. And so what that means is that we live in a world that is seriously enchanted, where there's a battle for the soul of creation itself that's being waged all the time. And a lot of Christians think like, well, since we know the ending, it doesn't really matter that much to look into how the battle is going right now. And I would say, well, we do know the ending. We know that Christ wins. He already won. He'll work out his victory, and then, you know, it'll finally reach its zenith at the end of time. But that doesn't mean that there's not interesting things happening right now. You know, when the men of the West stood at the Black Gates of Mordor and watched Barad-dûr crumble after the ring fell into Mount Doom, they won. They had won. And yet there was still a lot of interesting stuff that had to happen between then and, you know, the men really ushering in their age of rule in the earth. And so, first of all, I think that the world is enchanted. And the reason that that's important for stories is because man is a story-driven creature. God made us not to be ultimately compelled and persuaded by notes and data points. God made us to be persuaded ultimately by a story, particularly the one that he is writing. And that's the thing. This is why the Bible isn't a systematic theology textbook that just has bullet points of like, here's what you need to know about God and sin and salvation. No, otherwise, what would we argue about? You know, like there has to be stuff to fight about. And so that's why God wrote the Bible as a narrative, because he knows us better than we know ourselves. And he knows that he made us to be really interested in the tension, in the darkness, in the light, in the contrast, in the hope, in the sorrow of good story. And so, since we are firmly convinced, and when I say we, I mean all of us here in Ogden, since we're firmly convinced that that's true, we wanted to take an approach with media, whether it's King's Hall or Haunted Cosmos, that feeds into that, that tries to just say, okay, this is clearly the way that God made man. At least it's the way he made us, you know, maybe everyone else is different. So what if we just looked at the world and tried to approach these strange things by telling compelling stories, not to really even lead anyone to any certain conclusion, although we freely share our own conclusions, but just to lead people to thinking about how the world is far more magnificent, far more magical, if you want to use that word, than we previously have been taught that it is, especially from the 19th century on to now. And so Dr. Joe Rigney talks about it like the scales being broken from our eyes and falling down. It's not that we've lost enchantment. It's that materialism is a counter-enchantment that's telling us a lie, and it's putting a thicker shroud over our head. So instead of seeing through a glass dimly, we're trying to see through a brick wall, you know? And so we want good stories that are true, you know, to the best of our knowledge, but that are also just opening doors of thought and, you know, ways to see the world that God made. We want those things to be like a sledgehammer going against the brick wall. It's breaking it down and letting people see like, no, the world actually is far more mystical than you could have possibly imagined. In fact, there was one tweet that I saw from a friend of mine who I really, really love, but I couldn't tell if he was subtweeting me. I don't know. And it said, you know, some people wish that the Old Testament was more like the Silmarillion, this book by J.R.R. Tolkien, which I love. It's my favorite book of all time. And I know what he means.
It takes a special kind of nerd to like the Silmarillion more than any else in Tolkien's work. Just saying.
Oh man, it's the best. It's the best book in the English language. I'm just saying that.
All right,
it's amazing. But I know what he means. Like, you don't want to just insert all of this fanaticism into the Old Testament that's not actually there. But the truth is, the Old Testament and the world in general is a lot more like the Silmarillion than it is materialism. Yeah. There are, you know, fallen angels that are fighting. There are angels that have not fallen, that are, you know, ministers of God's wrath and mercy, that are also active in the world. You know, there's powers and principalities that the church wrestles against. There's all these things happening, and we're part of it. And so we have to figure out what part we're supposed to play.
Yeah, and let's stay there for a little bit. I do want to get us really practical in this episode, but let's stay there for a few minutes, because it does, the way you're describing it makes me think of, you know, we're in underworld, you know, being enchanted by a spell that tells us that Narnia doesn't exist, right? And and we're slowly starting to believe that underworld is all there is. And that's that sort of, we've lost that, the enchanted world. And when we read the Bible, it seems like we have one of two choices. Either we can see it full of, you know, cosmic powers that Christ put to shame on the cross, and these principalities and powers of darkness that Paul says we're wrestling against, and the principalities in the world that Paul tells the Galatians not to go back and become enslaved to once again. And there's giants, and there's mountain people, and there's, you know, there's these nightshades that are talked about in Isaiah, and there's all this fantastical stuff. And we have one of two things to do with it. Either we disenchant scripture itself so that we can live in a material world, or we open ourselves up to the idea that perhaps the world's a little bit more like Tolkien than any of us want to believe. And and I think that what I've appreciated about what you guys are doing is, with your Bibles open, and with, you know, Christian thoughts running through your heads, you're trying to make sense of option two. Let's take option two, and let's look at the world and say, what if it really is like the Bible says, and these aren't just weird metaphors or the way things used to be, and now, you know, we've gotten way more materialistic. And I do think that you're right, it's a better story, right? And so, you know, I would take, and I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, Genesis 6 and whether you take the Sethite view, and I have friends who take the Sethite view, but when you look at the idea, and I think it was Heiser who maybe first introduced me to this, Non-Tenet really took it a little further in Spine of Scripture. Mm-hmm. Listening to you guys really tease out some nuances of it has helped. But this story that includes not just God sending man into the world, man falling and sending his son to redeem, that's a beautiful story in and of itself. But when you weave into it this idea that there are these fallen sons of God who have tried to corrupt, you know, God's good creation and sort of attack the genetic line that they know they're doomed, right? The snake crusher that's promised in Genesis 3:15 is going to come from, and that there's this cosmic battle being waged. And it, you even get to the New Testament, you hear, you know, Paul talk about things like, you know, don't you know that you'll judge angels and all these kinds of things. And it makes sense all of a sudden of like, well, one of the sub-threads of the story of Scripture is that God is replacing his disobedient celestial sons with obedient sons of earth conformed to the image of his celestial son. I mean, it's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I mean, one of the dominoes that was really heavy for me when it fell was it Genesis 6 viewed through this, you know, fallen angel intermarrying with human women lens is like, it makes sense that they would do that because the serpent heard the whole plan.
That's right. Like, he was right there.
God is the ultimate shot caller. He's sitting there and like looking at his enemy. And he's like, by the way, here's what I'm going to do. Okay. There's going to be a seed of this woman. I know she seems very weak, very easy to deceive, all these things, but actually her offspring is going to be the one to kill you. So congratulations and enjoy your wait, you know? And so it makes perfect sense now that all of his energy and thought and will would be turned towards corrupting that seed and that line and making it actually so that he can thwart God's plan, in the end. And of course he thinks that he does, and of course he doesn't, but these things, it's like, and some of it too is, I think that we can sometimes fall into the trap of actually being a little bit self-centered and not at least giving some weight to the idea that God's eternal decree isn't only focused on man. Like, yes, of course, it's all about his glory, and it ultimately radiates in Christ and Christ's victory and man redeemed. You know, man fell and now he's restored and he's redeemed and then he'll be glorified. Like, that's the focus. Maybe a better way to say it is that I think it's a mistake to say that within that focus, within that main plot, there can't be subplots that also feed into it that have less to do with man. For example, a common Reformed understanding that you can find in guys like Bob Inc. in volume 2 of his Dogmatics is that the spiritual realm is actually more diverse, more varied, and more mysterious than the physical realm. And I mean mysterious in the sense that, like, you can't find everything. I'm like, well, I wonder what would make someone think that. I wonder what would make someone say that in a systematic textbook. And I think the answer is that he was onto this idea, and, you know, men before him were onto this idea that, yes, man is this really important character in the story that God's telling, but he's not the only character. Like, every good story has a subplot that builds more tension and that ultimately feeds into the foil of the story that, you know, makes the grand reveal at the climax or at the end all the more greater. And so to me, this sort of angel, fallen angel thing is kind of like that. It's a subplot that God is using to just further magnify his glory. Like the idea that Christ's transfiguration took place on the summit of Mount Hermon, where the angels fell and where they planted their flag against God in high rebellion and said, no, you know, we will defeat you. And then Christ goes up there, just the seed of the woman, and he shows himself in glory, you know, with the law and with the prophets. And in so doing, he's claiming victory over those fallen angels that tried to rebel against him so long ago. Like, that to me just, it adds so much more richness and so much more depth to the story that ultimately just makes me want to go back to the scriptures and go back to prayer and go back to singing psalms and being like, this is like, how great of a mind must it be that can come up with this? This is the most beautiful thing that I could never even come up with or never imagine.
Yeah. One of the things I preached through Genesis, or I've been preaching through Genesis over the last couple of years. I'm in Genesis 49 this Sunday, so I'm getting, nice. I'm winding down, but it's been a long, long time. And I remember being back in Genesis 1, and one of the things that I saw there that I hadn't seen prior to preaching through it this time around was, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it was the earth that was formless and void. So God creates, you know, a two-tiered universe, and in that two-tiered universe, it seems to me as though he makes the heavens full and mm-hmm. complete, and he does it instantaneously. And then he creates the earth, where he begins to fashion it into, he begins to fashion it and fill it, and yet he takes his time with it, 6 days. So instantaneous heavens, you know, an earth that takes 6 days. He creates the heavens and they're complete, and yet the earth isn't complete because outside of Eden, it's still an untamed wilderness that he's going to tell Adam, you know, go and take dominion of it. And it, the heavens are filled with celestial beings of all kinds and all kinds of diversity. And then on the earth, he says, now your job is to fill it, go and fill it with my image bearers. Mm. And so it's like God sets Adam in the garden with a blueprint, right? That, you know, Eden's this place where heaven and earth touch. And he gives him the blueprint and says, now go make the rest of the created world look like the blueprint you see in heaven. Fill it with all kinds of diversity and complete it, right? And that's such a compelling piece of the story that we so often forget. We forget that when God didn't create Adam in the garden, Adam fell, and the whole point of the story is to get back to Eden. It doesn't go from garden to garden. Right. It goes from garden to garden city. And so there's something about our involvement in God's story that actually brings completion to this great epic that he's writing.
Yeah, 100%. That theme even seems to be touched with Abraham and God calling Abraham out and telling him to look up at the stars and to think, like, that's going to be your descendants. Look up at the stars. That's more than just Oh, there's a lot of them. God is seldom so shallow as that, you know. That's really interesting to me. I love that. I also think, and Augustine talks about this in City of God, this interesting idea of like when the angels were created, like what was the time in creation that they were made. And he seems to believe, if I'm reading him right, that the angels were created when God said, "Let there be light," that the physical manifestation of pure spirit, in anthropomorphized language, is just light, like this pure elemental thing that's just beautiful and glorious and warm. And I love that. I love this idea that in Job 38, when God asks Job, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth, when the sons of God sang with the stars of the dawn?" Or in Judges 5, like 22, I think, when Deborah and Barak are singing their song, and they say that the stars fought against Sisera. I like this idea that that's not just metaphor, like that there's something more to it. Whether it's purely spiritual or whether it's some kind of crossover thing, I don't really care. I just want people to admit that that's not language that's just, that's merely flowery and beautiful, but it also means something real. That like it's a data point in our study of nature where we can say God is so great that he can create pure light, whatever that means. And then perhaps that's when the angels were created too. But whether or not that's true, we know because God said that when he made the foundations of the earth, the sons of God were there and they were singing with these other things. And those other things were the stars of the dawn. And those same stars also fought to help God's people win against Sisera, this evil king. And then you come back to what you're saying, how that like clearly ties in with this heavenly blueprint, starry blueprint, and then this Abrahamic also heavenly blueprint idea. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it's and of course, you know, we could talk about this forever, but you know, the idea of how stars are used throughout scripture, right? When God judges a nation, yeah, and it talks about stars falling to the ground, and I think many Christians trying to be hyper literal have read that and thought of it, immediately pushing all of this into an apocalyptic future, but understanding that this is what he's talking about. He's talking about the principalities, the powers, yeah, behind those nations being judged and thrown to the ground. And so this idea that there are stars warring when nations war, because there are principalities behind these nations, like the Prince of Persia and the Prince of Greece, as we see in Daniel. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating because, Psalm 139 talks about how every one of our days was written in God's book before any of them came to pass. And to think that he wrote the story of us and our children and our children's children, as well as he's writing the story of these celestial wars in the sky that mirror and coincide with human wars, it does give you the sense that you're in the Iliad or the Aeneid. You're part of, yeah, this bigger cosmic battle that's going on.
And it makes sense too that the, at least at a symbolic level, but I would argue it much more than that, the stars and the starry host are supposed to be like a bridge between, you know, us earthly creatures and how we are supposed to see heaven and the dwellings of heaven, that are bathed in this like insane array of color and light and things like that. Of course, now, you know, we look up at the stars and we see mostly black with a couple pricks of white. But it didn't used to always be like that. Before we had these like Saruman-esque industrialized, you know, countries, it was vibrant color, and it's amazing. And I mean, even that, just our inability to look up at the stars and see what we ought to see is an indictment on our culture enough. But it is amazing to think of what will be as Christianity continues to succeed in the world and the gospel continues to change hearts and redeem people, how that will change too, how we'll be able to yet again to look up at the stars and see, oh, that's what the Lord meant when he told Abraham to number the stars and think of his offspring. Like, that's a pretty insane promise. That's an audacious thing to tell a mere man to do, you know?
Absolutely. So I think we could wax poetic about all this for a long, long time, but I'd like to kind of turn our conversation a bit, because this series is about how to win the world. And so I want to take what we've been talking about and I guess understanding the part that we play in God's big story, and kind of say, okay, how do we now win the world by telling better stories? And I think that you guys have done this really well in Ogden's, which is why it's not just the kind of haunted cosmos and the view of the celestials that I think you're a great guest for this particular episode. But I think you guys have really caught on to the idea that to get people, to get Christians swept up in the story of God, you need to give them their place in the story. You need to help them understand the time in which they live, the place in which they live, what they're supposed to do. So let's talk a little bit about how telling better stories will help to win the world. And maybe I'll just throw it out to you and let you kind of, what are you thinking about this? But I'll give you some thoughts. You know, I've often said to parents who have kids who, you know, in our church, when we had an influx of people through the whole COVID era, we had a whole lot of people who came into the church and didn't have our convictions about state-run schools. And so one of the first things we always say is get your kids out of the state-run schools. But you have these kids who are teenagers and they've been going to public school for however long, and they get swept up with, you know, the LGBT stuff. And one of the things I often tell parents is you need to tell them a better story than the world is telling them. Because the story that they're hearing at school is that you get to define who you are. You get to set your own destiny. You get to identify in any way you are and to kind of, you know, write your own stars, so to speak. And you have to tell a better story than that. And I think that the general story that Christians tell their kids about just obedience without understanding the cosmic story is setting them up to try to make them choose something that seems so boring and mundane as opposed to, you know, the allure of this compelling story over here. Same thing with churches. I think a lot of times, you know, people, the reason they choose to immerse themselves in work or in particular hobbies or whatever, rather than their church life, is because their church doesn't have a story. Their church isn't about anything. Their church isn't engaging in this cosmic story in any way. So those are some of the thoughts I have. Maybe you could just kick it off and we'll see where this conversation goes. How is it that telling better stories wins the world?
Man, those are all great thoughts. I think one of the things that we like to say is that the things that you do shape your affections. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a counseling like pastoral situation, it's a husband who is failing to love his wife. And we say like, well, you have to love your wife. You have to live with her and understand. You just can't be mad at her. Like you can't snap at her. You know, you have to be kind. And he says, well, I don't feel like being kind. Well, I actually don't care if you don't feel like being kind at all. You just have to do it. And as you do it, and as you ask the Lord to give you faith in doing it, and he does, then your affections are trained to where it's no longer that you don't feel like it anymore. You actually delight in being kind to your wife. So doing things shapes your affections. In the same way, whatever you take in shapes your affections. And since we live in a world that is a story, we live in a world of many competing stories, and all of them are vying for your attention. And I think one of the things Christians have missed is that they forget that theirs is actually the best story around. Like the story that God's telling, the story that's contained in the scriptures and then worked out in history is the best one. But we've stopped thinking about it like that. And so it doesn't shape us as much anymore. Now we think about it almost in this like, yeah, like this kind of happened. Like maybe, I guess maybe Christ was born. Maybe it was a virgin birth. I don't know. I wasn't there, right? I can't verify. Maybe he rose from the dead. Maybe they were mistaken. Or even worse maybe than that, because that's obviously horrible. But what's maybe even more conniving is the person who says, yes, I believe all those things happened, but those were blips on the radar of a mostly materialist history that's functionally just deist, and God has very little hand to play in it. I think those people are at huge risk of having their souls completely lost. And the problem, and the reason why, is because they aren't properly seeing that thing that they're dismissing, inappropriately, by the way, is the story that is the fountainhead of all other stories. So you're inevitably going to be tossed about by every wind and doctrine. And so we've seen the church lose this conviction that the real story is the one that God's telling, and everything else is an echo of that. Whether it's a good echo or a corrupted echo is beside the point. Everything else isn't the real substance. It's all a shadow. And so you start to get things like a genuine idolatrous view of marriage, for example, where you actually forget that marriage is the thing that's a metaphor. A lot of people are like, oh yeah, Christ and the church, it's like marriage. It's like a husband and a wife. No. A husband and a wife is like Christ and the church. It's very different. Christ and the church is the actual marriage. All of ours are just types and shadows. But if we lose that grounding, then we're going to be tossed around by all of these new ideas. Thus, the drift of the church ever closer to perdition for her and all of her members. Of course, it won't go there, but it's drifting that way nonetheless. Then I think you can start to see the importance of fiction. And so one of the things that I always tell people is that for every like one nonfiction book I read, I try to read at least three fiction books that are good. And the reason for that is that story has a way of implanting principles into our hearts that's really subtle, but that has more staying power. You know, I can read all day something like Courage is Good. I can read that all day and I can say it and I can believe it, you know, sincerely. But I won't really know it until I read something, you know, like The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and I read about Reep Cheap and his audacious courage and all. and reading about him, like, it never once tells me that he was super courageous. It never does that. But it shows me what courage looks like in all these different settings. And then when Lewis comes in and he says, and then Eustace took up the sword and he ran at the serpent, and he actually didn't do anything helpful, but it was courageous nonetheless. I can sit there and think, oh, he's right. And so therefore Eustace deserves the honor that he receives for that completely pointless waste of time that was nonetheless courageous. And that gets into your bones really deep. And so, yeah, I think that that's really good. Like encouraging people to teach good stories to their kids, to tell them good stories, to give them a good story, but then to realize that they have a part to play in it. That they don't just get to sit back and read and listen, they actually have to do something about it. And this is where I'm stealing from Joe Rigney again, this distinction between first names and last names. So if your son comes up to you and he's like, hey, I really want to, like, I don't know, play guitar or something, I don't know, you can say, well, that's great. I would love for you to learn an instrument. You know, what kind of music are you thinking? And he's like, oh, I want to learn how to play all the Tool songs. Okay, well, now we have a problem, because it's good that you, Abner, first name Abner, want to learn an instrument that I never learned. But it's bad that you, last name Garrett, Abner Garrett, want to do something that is contradictory to what our family knows is true, to what our family knows is good and beautiful. So you can learn the guitar, but you can't learn the guitar to play Tool. Instead, you have to learn the guitar to play something good, true, and beautiful. So everyone has a part to play, and they can really take up these things and they can run with them. My son can run with the guitar if he ever wants to, and I'll cheer him on all the way, but he can't run anywhere he wants. He has to run along the right path because he has a last name. In the same way, all of mankind is a single unit from a single seed. We're all from Adam. We're all from Adam and Eve. And so in that sense, man is unified as one corporate body. But each person really is their own person. Each man really is a microcosmos, you know? And so that man has no excuse to sit back and say, well, God will do what he will. I'll let go and let God. I have nothing that I can actually do to affect anything whatsoever. It's all just brute determinism and I'm along for the ride. That's just sin. What you have to do is realize that, yes, God is sovereign. God is the one in control. He'll providentially guide all things. But God also made you to do things. God didn't make Christians to sit back and just watch the world pass. He made Christians to go and disciple the nations and baptize them and teach them everything that Christ commanded. And so I think it's really important that as we're talking about the importance of stories and their great persuasive ability for good or bad, especially in children, but no less in adults, it's also important that we bring home this idea that, and now you have to go and do this thing. And so to your point about churches not having a story, I think that's a great point. And one of the things that we've really tried to do here in Ogden is say, the vision for our church is a 500-year vision. None of us will be alive to see it, whether it fails or succeeds. But the vision is this, that Utah would be a Christian state, that we'd have hundreds of thriving, Reformed churches up and down the Wasatch Mountains and all in the desert, and every single one of them would be bearing fruit to the glory of God. That's what we want in 500 years. And so what do I have to do right now to play my part in making that happen? Well, I have to pursue audacious things like starting businesses or trying to become a minister or starting a podcast where you talk about Bigfoot, or we have to start a school. Or it could be as simple as, because I want Utah to be a Christian state in 500 years, I need to go home and I need to be a patient but disciplined father. I need to be a loving and kind husband who doesn't shrink back from the responsibility of leading his wife, because I have daughters and I want them to be able to look at my wife and see a woman who is a glorious crown on her husband's head, who is submissive, who's a gentle and quiet spirit, but who is nonetheless skilled and wise and strong and loving and all these great things. And if you don't tie those seemingly small duties in to this grand vision and story that you're telling, then ultimately you'll never move beyond just a merely obligatory action. And it's fine if actions are obligatory at the beginning. Like I said, what you do trains your affections. But if they never move beyond that, then you know that there's something missing somewhere on the line. And I think one of the things that's consistently missing is story and reminding people that you're part of one, and you're part of one whose stakes are eternally high, and you're part of one that matters greatly for you.
Man, that is so good. That's I think I just kind of inceptioned you with your next great book project. I know you're in the middle of one right now. So this is, if I could throw my hat in the ring, this is what you should write about next. 100%. but this is, it's interesting because I'm listening to you talk. I think there's two really important things that I think fiction does for us. And you talked about even your ratio of kind of 3-to-1 in terms of nonfiction and fiction. I remember I was in English literature going to school and when I got saved. And honestly, like I would say literature and kind of wanting to be in the academic English realm was such an idol to me that when I first got saved, I sort of pushed fiction aside, thinking I was being really righteous in doing so, and said, I'm only going to read, you know, Christian books. And I immersed myself mm-hmm. in all kinds of Puritan theology and stuff. And you know, God certainly used it. But it's interesting because you said, you know, you can read all the time, courage is good, courage is good. But there is something about fiction that teaches us theology in an especially, yeah. I remember this just kind of going back, personal illustration, but I think it might be helpful for those listening. I remember I really struggled when I grew up in the sort of charismatic church, walked away from faith. I was never truly saved, got saved in university campus life. And when I did, I got drawn into Reformed theology. But I was really struggling with the idea of what we would call Calvinism, right? Reformed soteriology. I really struggled with it. I was one of those rebellious, like, oh no, four-pointer, you know, all this kind of stuff, yeah. And rejecting limited atonement. Just as a side note, limited atonement becomes much easier to deal with scripturally when you become post-millennial as well. So maybe put those things so together. True. Yeah. But I struggled with it for a long time. And it wasn't until I remember I was actually watching, so you're gonna maybe chastise me, but I was watching Lord of the Rings, and at the end there, when Frodo, I've read it, so I didn't watch it first, and as Frodo is struggling with whether or not to throw the ring away and you know save Middle Earth at the end, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read it, but shame on you if you haven't. And I remember having this moment where I'm just like, interesting. If we think about Frodo in that way, Tolkien's written the end of this story. Whether or not he throws the ring and destroys it is already predetermined. It's predestined. And yet yeah. I'm not finding myself in the moment of this struggle, you know, kind of going like, oh, come on, this isn't real. He's not a true character because Tolkien has predetermined whether or not this isn't a real struggle, right? Because we suspend yeah. disbelief when we understand it's a story. And in that moment, that character had a very real decision to make, even though the author predestined its end. And I find that that was such a maybe it's just the way I'm wired, but for me, that was like, oh, that's how I should be thinking about God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. I am still a character in the story, and God has written every single one of the pages of my story into his great story. But that doesn't mean in my moments of conflict and temptation that I'm not a real character with these real things going on. And so I say that simply to say that I think fiction can teach us theological truths in a way that sometimes just reading the theological textbook doesn't get across to us.
Yeah, 100, actually, there's a great example of that in The Silver Chair, in Lewis's Silver Chair, where Jill and Eustace, they just got to Narnia, and Aslan has already blown Eustace over the sea towards Narnia, and he's talking to Jill. And he and Aslan says, I brought you here for a reason. You have to go on this mission. And Jill says, what are you talking about? We were the ones that called you. And as it's this great, it's so good. It brings home all of these genuinely like robust theological ideas. Aslan just says, if I had not been calling you, you would not have called me. And it, like, you wouldn't have called me if I hadn't been calling you first. And it's this great rebuke, but it's so true. Like, little things like that, little quips like that are actually the things that convince people. And I was actually talking to a really good friend of mine last night at dinner, and he's not quite there on Calvinism. And we were talking, and I was like, okay, think of it like this. I'll use your Frodo example. When Frodo was standing, you know, in Ordo Druin, and he's thinking about whether or not he's going to throw the ring over, who is the one that's acting? Is it Frodo who's holding the ring and he's wondering what he's going to do? Or is it Tolkien who's writing Frodo? Well, it's both. Frodo is 100% there, being conflicted with all these things and trying to fight the temptation and knowing what's right and having a hard time doing it. Frodo is really doing that. It's 100% Frodo. But it's 100% Frodo because it was 100% Tolkien writing it. Like, I am able to act freely because God is the one that has decreed that I act freely in that way. We can only, like, humans can only actually be free in this reformed understanding of how God's sovereignty works. Anything else isn't real freedom because anything else doesn't have a real, ultimately sovereign God. And the crazy thing is that stories are the ones that really help you get that. It's I don't know what it is. It's just there's something different about hearing it from a fictional character's mouth, but it sticks with us. It's almost like they're trustworthy, you know, because they're a product of this world that doesn't exist. And it, I don't know. There's just something that seems so trustworthy about certain fictional characters, and even though they don't exist, they say something, and because they're trustworthy, you're just like, yeah, that's what I believe now, wholeheartedly.
Right. They do have a way of implanting these things. So that's a theological side. The other side that I was thinking of is how often, you said your son's name is Abner. I don't know how many kids you have.
Just three, one in the womb, but Abner, Ambrose, and then a little girl who we haven't named yet.
Oh, praise God. So my kids are 8, 6, 4, and we got a little one. And so it's interesting how often you can use shorthand with your kids when you read them a lot of stories, right? Yeah. So I have three girls and one boy, and you know, boys are generally a little bit more destructive, a little bit more, you know, of a whirlwind. And so Judah is his name. And sometimes you'll have to talk to him about, you know, the girls spend all this time making something out of Lego, and Judah can come in and destroy it fairly quickly. And one of the things I often will say to them is, you know, don't be a Sid, right? From Toy Story. Yes,
and, right? I've and been like, saying that, know, to Abner too.
Do you? There you go. We probably stole it from somebody smarter than us along the way, but the idea there, right? Don't destroy things for the sake of destroying them, right? Don't do that. And you can do, like you talked about the courage of Reepicheep, Cheap, right? And you can talk about, you know, when I was reading Chronicles of Narnia to my kids, we had all kinds of great stories about, so it was starting in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe about Edmund. I remember my kids sort of gasping when Edmund lies to the rest, to Peter and Susan about going back into Narnia and how nasty that is to Lucy. And talking to them about that and just being able to say, well, isn't that always what we want to do when we're mad at one another? Don't we always want to hurt, want to lash out, want somebody to pay? Right? There's ways of talking to our kids, discipling our kids, and there's ways of kind of utilizing shorthand to kind of say, well, what kind of character do you want to be in God's story? And honestly, I think I got this from N.D. Wilson, where he said, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to myself, I'll just ask that question: what kind of a character are you right now? Right? Yeah. Are you the sort of pouty, wimpy, cowardly, passive aggressive guy that nobody is going to look up to, nobody wants to be like? Right? Are you the shrill wife who's really cold and everybody has to walk around on eggshells around you? Are you the disobedient child who's trying to hurt those around you? Right? What kind of character do you want to be? You're a character in a story right now. Are you a hero or are you a villain? Right? Are you somebody yeah. that the reader is rooting for or somebody that the reader is rooting against? I think that's such a helpful and practical thing as we think about ourselves and God's story, is what kind of character are we? Because we all know what it means to long to be Luke Skywalker, right? And loathe, you know, the Emperor or Jar Jar Binks or whoever else you might loathe in the Star Wars universe. But I think characters are so powerful in that regard, because we either want to be like them or we don't want to be like them at all.
Yeah. That's so good. Like we say all the time when we're talking mostly to our sons, do you think that you're a hero or a villain right now? Mm-hmm. And just seeing what they say. And often, you know, of course, my son's three and he's like, I'm a hero, you know, because he knows he's in trouble. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, see, that's where you're wrong. You're actually not a hero right now. This is what Sid would do, you know, whatever it is. This is what Edmund would do before he was redeemed, all these things. And then the other thing that I like to do is, so there's the shorthand stuff, but then there's also the big, thick porterhouse steak stuff that you feed your kid even when they're too young to chew on it, but you still just get them thinking in these terms. So for example, one of the things that I like to say to my son is don't kick against the goads, because he's in this place right now where he's finally starting to understand the pecking order of the home, that he's not the god of the home. And actually he's like fairly low on the totem pole of authority and freedom and all these things. And naturally, you know, that makes it hard to obey. It's offensive. It goes against our fallen nature. And so it's harder for him now. It really is. But part of my duty as a father is to get him to love the place that he's in, because it's for his good. And as he gets older, that corresponds to loving good hierarchy that God's put into the world, like being respectful to your boss, being loving to your wife, submitting to your elders, all these things. And then also, submitting to just where God has you in life. It helps you be more content when you're not kicking against the goads of providence. But when I tell Abner, like, hey, don't kick against the goads, he has no idea what I'm talking about. But when I'm reading to him and I'm reading, Beatrix Potter, Peter Rabbit, and we get to the part where it's like, yeah, and he lost another coat and he lost more shoes and he didn't get to eat blackberries and milk and bread that night. He got to drink chamomile tea and go straight to bed. And I get to look at Abner, who's just loving the story. And I'm like, so Peter Rabbit kicked against the goads. He didn't just love the place that he was in. And instead he tried to steal something that wasn't it. Like all these great things. And then you hear your three-year-old start saying things like, I don't want to kick against goads and stuff. And as they grow up, and as their understanding of the story that they're in matures, they start to have a whole new understanding of what that means. So that when they get to that section in scripture where Christ is blinding Paul and he's asking, why do you keep kicking against the goats? Yeah. They'll finally be like, oh, I was like Saul before he was converted. Yeah. You
know? Totally. Yeah.
Like little Easter eggs that they can enjoy for the rest of their life.
That's so good. Well, brother, I feel like we could have this conversation for hours on end, but I think we've said what we need to say in order for this to be edifying and encouraging for those listening. So I want to just thank you for coming on. And why don't you quickly just kind of give people a plug for where they can find you, how they can kind of become supporters of everything you're doing over at Haunted Cosmos. So where can people find and follow you?
Yeah, thanks, man. You can find me at Tom Pombadil on Twitter, like Tom Bombadil, but with pawn instead of bomb. You can follow Haunted Cosmos at Haunted Cosmos _ on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it. You can also support us on patreon.com/HauntedCosmos. We release an exclusive patron-only show every week. It's called The Dusty Tome. Brian came up with that name. And we try to give our patrons far more value than they're supporting us with, just as a way to honor them, really, because without them, the show is completely impossible. So if any of that interests you, you should check it out. If none of it interests you, then maybe just check out an episode of Haunted Cosmos on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or YouTube and tell me what you think.
Awesome. Well, once again, this is Ben Garrett from Haunted Cosmos, and we are telling you, don't be a Sid, be Frodo, be Tom Bombadil, be a hero in the story in which God's placed you. Learn your place and learn to love it, and live in God's world in such a way that when you face him, you'll hear the wonderful words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Thanks so much, and we'll see everybody next time.